From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, March the 11th, 2020, and we have a show that we are going to devote in large part to coronavirus and maybe some part to the round of primary elections that were held in six states yesterday. Joe Biden won four out of six. Looks like Bernie Sanders may be in some big trouble out there, actually. So we'll be talking about that in the latter hour of the program. But I wanted to devote this first hour to updating folks on where we are with the coronavirus outbreak, and wanted to bring in a couple of people who are very thoughtful on healthcare issues in Vermont to chat with us about what they're seeing and hearing out there, and understanding about what folks ought to be thinking about the coronavirus. And by virtue of an update here, the latest news from the Vermont Health Department is that Vermont has had one case that is a presumptive finding of coronavirus down in the Bennington area. I believe confirmatory test results are still being awaited from the Federal Centers for Disease Control, and that's when you get the official diagnosis, although the test is resulting in a quarantine of the patient. The Vermonters who have been tested and found to be negative for the COVID-19 virus, 40 so far. Vermonters being monitored are 226. Vermonters who have completed monitoring are 52. So the health department is tracking all of these statistics from around the state at healthvermont.gov. Healthvermont's all one word, .gov. You can find this information that they are putting out and updating. My intent has been to try to get someone from the Vermont Health Department on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV for the last couple of days. It's a difficult task, however. They tend to have their staff meetings between about 9 and 11 in the morning when we are on the air. So they're telling me they're all tied up on at this time of day. They tend to put out their newest information in the afternoons. So what I'm sharing with you right now is actually all as of yesterday afternoon. They did issue a new advisory saying that following new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, returning travelers whose last day in China, Italy, South Korea, or Iran was March 4th or afterward should stay home and monitor their health for 14 days after returning to the United States. Travelers returning from Japan should monitor their health for 14 days after returning to the United States. So there we go. That's the newest information from the Vermont Department of Health. And wanted to bring in a couple guests this morning to provide us their reflections and thoughts and insights on all of this situation here. Dr. Deb Richter is both an addiction specialist and a general practitioner who has a family practice in the town of Cambridge, Vermont, and has been very active in pushing for universal health care at the State House over the years. She is still very involved in an effort to bring about universal primary care in Vermont. And Dr. Richter, thanks so much for joining me in the studio this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And Hamilton Davis is a longtime journalist and a writer who has focused through much of his career, and especially in recent years, on the topic of healthcare in general. And Ham called me yesterday and was telling me that he thinks that the media need to be doing a better job asking better questions about what's going on in with this COVID-19 outbreak. And we're going to find out from Ham what his thoughts are on all of this over the course of our discussion. Ham Davis, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
I'm glad to be here, Dave.
Our call-in numbers are 244-1777. That's the local number here at our Waterbury studio. The toll-free number for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM and AM is 1-877-291-8255. And I'm trying to decide for myself, sort of, I've never been in a situation like this before. I haven't been around since the flu epidemic of 1919. And so this is the first time really through any kind of a health scare of this magnitude, I think, within my lifetime and within the lifetime of most of our listeners out there, and if not just about all of them. Deb Richter, have we ever experienced as a country since 1919 anything like this before?
Well, I think it's wise to keep in mind that we do deal with the flu every single year, where tens of thousands of Americans die, hundreds of thousands around the world. And, you know, again, a lot of people ignore this threat. I see it every day where people say, well, I don't get the flu. I don't get the flu shot. I don't want to get the flu from the flu shot. And so a lot of people, you know, don't avoid doing that. Just proper hygiene, washing your hands frequently, making sure that, you know, you're wiping down surfaces at the grocery store, those sorts of things. We've dealt with that. However, the flu is generally a known quantity. It's something that we are aware of. We have some prevention, and we actually have a form of the Tamiflu. It's a form of some, you know, curbing of some of the symptoms of the flu. But not to this extent where we have an unknown quantity and what we really don't know. We do know how it is transmitted. We know it's in the respiratory droplets, people sneezing and coughing who have it. We do know that. We don't know, for example, who the vectors are. Again, with the flu, it's commonly children actually are the biggest vectors of the flu. Is that the case now? Because we do know that young people have a tendency to be either asymptomatic, having no symptoms, or very mild symptoms. And so they don't often seek care as a result, and we don't even really know much about that. So this is not something we've seen in our lifetime. And again, because of the international travel, it is spreading around the world. And we can expect to see this continue, in my view. I don't think, as the president has said, this is going to disappear in April. It's possible that it will reduce because people are more apt to be outdoors in less crowded spaces, et cetera. But it is not something that we have seen in our lifetime.
And Hamilton Davis, you said you had a couple questions you would like to ask Dr. Richter here, and so I'm going to kind of give the floor to you for a couple of minutes and see what's tops on your list right now.
Well, I've read all the national news about the virus and the difficulty with it and so forth. What I was concerned about, why I called you, Dave, was that I hadn't seen very much local reporting. Now, in point of fact, there isn't much local reporting of any kind at all. I mean, there's some, but not a lot. And so I just had basic questions like, the national news is full of problems that they've had nationally with getting the test kits. And so there are test kits. Now, this is easy for Deb, and I'm so glad I didn't realize Deb would be here. If I hadn't asked you, I would have asked her. If you need a test kit to diagnose the disease, who's got the test kits? Do primary care docs in Vermont have the test kits? Do hospitals have the test kits? Do emergency rooms have the test kits? Are they using the test kits? Now, I heard you say today, Dave, that the health department has said that they've tested 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that once the disease really gets going, it really comes in on slowly, apparently, but it can ramp up really fast. I assume it can get exponential in its rate of increase. Are we prepared for that? I have no idea. I mean, how many kits do you need? I'd ask Deb. Deb, can you figure out, you're a primary care doc.
Yes.
You don't have any test kits.
Well, we have, you know, again, we have swabs that we can use. So the problem I see is sort of the criteria for the testing itself has been somewhat limited. There have been, again, people who, if you look in other countries, for example, Germany is a good example where they have widely tested. Because, again, to contain this virus, the important thing is to identify early and isolate the people. So if you have someone even with mild cold symptoms in other countries, they're testing everyone. Hundreds of thousands of people in other countries are being tested. We have had a very limited testing, and a lot of it had to do with the initial testing from the CDC was erroneous. And again, some of this has to do with cutbacks in funding over the last 10 years or so. That the testing that they used was actually in error, so there was a delay there. And any delay in this is a problem.
I want to interrupt for just a moment because I don't want to ignore our listeners calling in, and we have had Stuart on the line from Worcester here for a few minutes. So let me bring in Stuart, if I could. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning. I have a question. You know, we've been hearing a lot about, you know, the effect of this virus on the general population. I'm wondering about those folks that are highly at risk, that are older, may have asthmatic conditions or lung problems. Most of those people have an emergency or crisis plan on file with their doctor. Would you recommend, Dr. Richter, would you recommend just having your crisis drugs on hand for when this flu arrives? I understand the crisis drugs won't cure the flu, but it's the kind of thing you would use if you've got the general flu. Should we have those on hand?
I think people should have certainly emergency supplies of food and water and things, you know, just in the event that they'd have to isolate for a two-week period. That would make a lot of sense. I also don't want people to panic in the sense that, you know, that they start hoarding. Again, a lot of people have been hoarding Purell and hoarding face masks, etc. But I think in terms of cold medicines, that sort of thing, yes, but Tylenol, Motrin, depending on. But I think the more important thing for people over the age of 60, myself included, would be to, if you go into any kind of a public space, like a grocery store, that you wipe down the cart, that you wipe down your hands before and after being in any kind of a public place, that you avoid touching your face, that you wash your hands once an hour for at least 20 seconds with soap and water. Those sorts of things are much more important to help prevent this. Remember, this has to be touch a mucous membrane, so such as the eye, the nose, and the mouth, in order to be ingested into your body. So sort of the common sense measures. I would say seniors and people should avoid any unnecessary travel. If your grandchildren are sick, it's probably a good idea not to have them visit. As far as having those sorts of things, yes, you need your prescription medications for sure, and having an extra supply of those is not an unwise decision. But I'm actually, again, much more concerned also with folks in crowded circumstances, for example, people in prisons and people in nursing homes. Those, we need extra precautions. So if your parent is in a nursing home, it's probably wise not to visit. So those sorts of common sense measures are. I'd also advise people to go to the health department website. There's a ton of information listed there. So it's healthvermont.gov. There's also information at the CDC. That's the Center for Disease Control.gov. And if you look at the page on COVID-19 or the coronavirus, it really pops up the minute you go to the CDC. So I think those are things that they can give you. I'm not a public health expert. I want to make that clear. I'm a primary care doctor. But that I think those are the sort of the common sense things, and also much more information that you can get at those two websites.
Well, thank you. Thank you for those comments. I am well read on this subject, and I do understand the necessity for prevention. I guess I'm asking, because the CDC recommended, you know, stocking up on your maintenance meds for people with chronic conditions, you know, I'm wondering if it's wise to have those crisis drugs on hand that you would use if you got into, you know, a serious regular flu.
Give me an example, Stuart, of a crisis drug. Are we talking about an inhaler and an asthma attack, or what are we talking about exactly?
We're talking about deep lung congestion, things like prednisone, Zithromax to prevent pneumonia.
Right. And so I would say, Stuart, it's important for you to contact your primary care provider under those circumstances. If you get to the point where you have shortness of breath from this illness, you're in deep trouble at that point. And that's really where you need to seek help. And that, again, is really why I'm concerned about this virus. I think it's taught us a lot, because the things you're bringing up, it's really a great demonstration as to why we really need to care about people having access to care. 40% of Vermonters have insurance so inadequate, a major illness would cause bankruptcy. Those people are hesitant to even use their insurance and call their doctor or visit their primary care provider. But if you're to the point where you're short of breath, that is where you're in trouble with this virus. This is really a problem. So a fever, dry cough, those are sort of the initial symptoms. But if you get to the point where you're short of breath, your lips are turning blue, you're severely short of breath, that's really the point where you need to seek help, most likely actually at a hospital.
That's very helpful. Thank you for those specific comments. I have just one other question, if we can. Early on in the game, one of the folks from the CDC predicted 70% of the world's population, or the U.S., would contact this disease. And today we've heard from Germany where they're predicting the same number. It sort of seems like it's inevitable that many of us are going to run into this. Do you have any comments on those figures?
Again, as I said, I'm not a public health expert. I would lean towards taking the word of someone from the Center for Disease Control rather than my predictions. I do think that this is going to become more widespread. And again, identifying the disease early and isolating the people who have it is fundamental. I think we will see some more school closures, which would be probably appropriate. And avoiding public places is also a very good idea.
Stuart, I got to jump, but thank you for the call. That's some excellent questions. Let's go to Rob in Montpelier. Good morning, Rob.
Yes. So I just heard earlier advising against unnecessary travel. And I have a moral dilemma here. I'm traveling to Norway next week to go see my sister. Like some clarity on sort of what's the best thing I can do to help in this global crisis.
Your basic question is, should you skip the trip, sounds like?
That's yes.
Should Rob skip the trip, Deb Ricker?
Well, I would say, how old are you, Rob?
33.
All right. And do you have any health problems?
No.
It's probably safe for you to travel, but with the understanding that you need to be incredibly careful about touching your face, that you need to be very, very careful about washing down surfaces, having a hand sanitizer with you, and using that at least once an hour if you don't shake hands with people. If you were, for example, carrying the virus because you're young, and sometimes, again, young people don't exhibit the symptoms of it. It would depend on the people that you're going to see at the other end. Would you be carrying the virus to a person who's 90 years old who has a lung problem, or someone, you know, even younger with a lung problem? That might be the bigger danger. It's not so much you, but are you carrying it? So it would be really important to continue to, you know, be mindful of washing your hands. And that is really one of the most effective things that people can do. And soap is very cheap, and it's also still available in the stores, unlike hand sanitizer. So I would say washing your hands very frequently. And again, the recommendation is once an hour. Again, just to keep from, because we touch surfaces all the time, we don't really know how long the virus will live on surfaces. So that's another issue. And be mindful of that. So it's probably safe. That is not one of the countries that has been considered. But I would keep up with the CDC. They have a travel alert where they are giving more recommendations, and it really depends on how many people in that country have been. There's three levels of travel, and I believe Norway would probably be one that would be safer. So, but being mindful of all of those public health measures.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call, Rob. Appreciate it. Ham Davis, you were saying that, I mean, you raised a really interesting point a moment ago on the break where you were talking about this. Some of the figures indicate that, or predictions from CDC indicate that the we could end up with 70% of the population of the United States actually contracting this disease. I don't know whether that means that includes, you know, all the people who are going to get it and never notice their symptoms, or all the people who are going to get it and actually get acutely ill in some manner or another. I mean, the definitions really matter here. But I wonder, 70% of the Vermont population is about 400,000 people. And you're somebody who follows the healthcare system here on a systematic basis in your writing and reporting. We don't have anything like 400,000 hospital beds in Vermont, do we?
No, and when I use the 70% number, I think that number is the number of people who might be seen as necessary to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the yield rate, so to speak, is for that. I have no idea what that is, and that probably varies pretty widely and is very dependent on the target population. Kids are not getting this. Young people are pretty much don't have to worry that if they have lung problems, of course they do. But the main problem is elderly people. But I just think that I just haven't seen enough data from Vermont. I heard a rumor the other day that UVM has 50,000 test kits. I don't. And Deb, we talked a little bit with Deb about what a test kit is. I'm not certain why you should need a test kit. Okay, you can have a swab. I'm not sure what's in a test kit. And there's a huge fighting. It's all over the New York Times. It was in there yesterday, and it's in there today, which is the CDC has one view about what the test kit needs to be. The Food and Drug Administration has another view. They argue about what's in the test kit. They argue about which kind of lab can take the test and test the swabs or whatever they are. And so my question simply is, if you're in Vermont today, if you're in Brattleboro or Island Pond or St. Albans or Brattleboro, if you start worrying about this, can you get tested? I mean, where do you go? Do you go to your primary care? Deb says she doesn't have any test kits now.
No, not true. I'm saying is that we have the capability to test people. The test is not done in our office, but much like, for example, we test for strep in our office. We have, that is not something, it's not like you can have a rapid strep test or a rapid test for the COVID virus. That, however, we have the capacity to test people, but they have to meet certain criteria.
The test kits then aren't critical? The fact of a kit.
Well, again, I'm not privy to I haven't seen these test kits, but the point is we send, I could do a throat culture on you and send it off to a lab and get the results of that throat culture. So I don't have a throat culture test.
Let's talk more about throat cultures and test kits after the break here for some bottom of the hour CBS News on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back, and my guests are Dr. Deb Richter. She's a primary care physician here in Vermont, as well as an addiction specialist. Ham Davis is a longtime writer on healthcare issues. We're talking about the COVID-19 virus, which is this just gigantic health scare that seems to be rippling through information, of course, always travels faster, even I think, than we hope it travels faster than this disease does. But and so the question then becomes, how solid is the information, and do people need to be, how scared do we all need to be? Should we all be making sure that our wills are up to date? What do we think about this, Deb Richter? There's a question, I think, for anybody over 60. Should you be making sure your will is up to date right now?
There's no doubt that people over 60 have a higher risk of dying from this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep in mind, by the way, that 80% of people do okay, that they either asymptomatic, no symptoms, or very few symptoms, and it resolves in about 10 to 14 days. But those, again, over 60 do, and especially those with health problems, and even younger people with health problems, have a higher death rate. That's absolutely true. Avoiding unnecessary travel, good hand hygiene, all those things are important. So I think if not worrying about test kits, what we really need to do is, if you have symptoms, for example, a fever, a dry cough, or a cough in general, or shortness of breath, you need to contact your primary care provider. If you don't have one, you should contact your emergency room. You can contact the health department. These are places where at least you can go to start the ball rolling in terms of what you should do next. And then the primary care provider will decide, you know, whether you need testing or not. A lot of times, this is not the common cold. This is, a lot of people are worried when they have a sniffle that, or they've sneezed, that they all of a sudden have COVID. I don't want people to panic in the sense that that is a symptom of that disease. It's not. So I think the other thing, though, but I think is important, in terms of what we do as a state, it's important for us to recognize, again, that our lack of a system, a healthcare system that truly is for everyone, where people do not hesitate to go to the doctor if they're ill, is something that we need to address. I think the governor needs to ask the legislature in an emergency to allocate funds for people if their children are sick or if they are sick, that they stay home from work. We don't want people working in a restaurant or a nursing home or some other capacity who may not have health insurance or has terrible health insurance they're afraid to use. We need those folks to stay home. So we need emergency funding for that. We need emergency funding for people to not hesitate to get to go to their primary care or get tested. And when people have copays and deductibles that they have to pay, those things should be waived. I think we also need to shore up our primary care offices in terms of reimbursing them for expenses when people can't pay their bills for this testing and treatment for this particular virus. So I think those are things that we need to take into consideration. But if you're worried, you call your primary care and we go from there.
Let's talk for a moment, and then I want to bring in Ham Davis on these questions too about the overall sort of public health approach. And you know, you're a big advocate of these days universal primary care. Deb Richter, even absent the COVID-19, we've talked about that on this program before. You know, we talk about these various social programs. One that occurred to me over the weekend was, of course, just the recent dust up under the Golden Dome over in Montpelier on paid family leave in Vermont. And the idea there being that an employee could get actually paid while taking time off from work, perfectly healthy, him or herself, but to care for, say, a newborn child in the house or to care for an elderly family member who might need to, you know, daily trips to get chemo or something. And meanwhile, there's this giant swath of the Vermont population, and my suspicion is it's growing. I haven't actually seen figures on this, but I just anecdotally from the people I know, I sort of sense that there are many, many more people out there who are, they don't have Blue Cross provided by their employer anymore, because we're living in a gig economy now. And if you're, you know, half your job is playing guitar on the weekends in bars and the other half of your job is driving Uber, where do you get your health insurance? You don't. Where do you get your paid time off? You know, the idea that employers give people, you know, 12 or whatever days a year to go home and be sick, that's not a happening thing anywhere near as much as it used to. So where are we on, I mean, how do people actually continue to pay their bills if they're suddenly told, oh, you got to take 2 weeks at home, you're not going to be working, you're not going to be making the tips you normally rely on for your rent?
Well, that's why I believe that the governor should actually ask the legislature to come up with emergency funding for the things, at least getting us through this virus, so that people will not hesitate to stay home if they are ill and they're under quarantine, and that they will not hesitate to seek medical care should they have serious symptoms or symptoms of this COVID virus. So those are things that could be done in the immediate sense. But this, you know, the only so-called silver lining that we could maybe see from this is the fact that this is a demonstration of why we really need to care about other people having access to health care and paid sick leave. This is a really good demonstration of that. And I think, you know, when we think that, oh, it doesn't matter that that other guy over there has diabetes and doesn't have any health care coverage, that may be just meaning that he will die. This means that if that person doesn't get care, I might die. And I think that's something that again, if it's a silver lining, it at least puts that out in the forefront. So people need to understand that this does affect them, that other people's health and ill health does affect them as well.
Let me put this little ethical dilemma, if I could, to Hamilton Davis. Hamilton Davis, let's say a younger relative of yours comes to you, you know, a grandchild. You're in your early 80s, I think I understand. Is that right? Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So I can imagine you might
I'm the target, Dave.
Okay. I can imagine you. That's why I'm trying not to cough at you. So just a FYI. I can imagine if you had a grandchild in his or her 20s who came to you and said, "Hey, Grandpa, I've been feeling lousy lately, and I haven't had this cough, but you know, I can't take time off from work because if I take time off from work, I just don't make any money. I don't have sick days at work, and if I don't make any money, I can't make my car payment. I can't, you know, how do I keep groceries in the house, and how do I pay the rent?" What do you say to that person?
Well, actually, that's not a theoretical, Dave. I have 7 grandchildren. They're all in their 20s. It's just hard. Every family would be different. You would, if you had a big family, an extended family, and some of them were fairly well off, then you would be able to just help them out. And that's if they were my grandchildren, that's what I would do. That doesn't really solve the problem that Dev sets out, though, because the fact that I might be able to help my grandchildren doesn't mean that somebody else could help theirs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I agree that it's a very difficult problem. And I think one of the things we haven't really thought through, I think, in Vermont, and I don't know what Deb, I'm curious what Deb's view is in this. I think that it's one thing to say, okay, here's how you deal with a case of, here's sort of a trajectory or a sketch of how you might deal with a case of the flu, and Deb is going to be in the trenches here, on the front trenches, on that kind of stuff, because she's a primary care doc, and the primary care doc community is going to have to be the front end of this whole system. My question is twofold. One is, and I'd be curious about what Deb thinks about this. One is, people don't talk very much about what they would actually do. Supposing I get it. I got it. Okay. In fact, when I drove down here this morning, Dave, there are big highway signs, you know, like there'll be a big, huge electric sign on I-89 that says there's a smash up ahead or there's going to be a huge storm. Mm-hmm. And there's a giant sign about every 20 miles on the interstate today that says COVID-19 is here.
Yeah.
So if that's true, then the relatively small numbers, one case, actual case confirmed, 40 cases that you heard about that got tested. Deb says she's ready to, you know, that if somebody comes in, she's going to be able to take the swab. She's going to be able to send out the test. I just don't have any idea whether we're ready for, not 70%, but we are, I don't think we're ready for 30 or 40,000 people. I mean, I just think I just don't believe that. We've got 700 primary care docs in Vermont. About that, that's a ballpark figure. That moves up and down, of course. There's 700 of them, and here comes 40, 50, 60,000 people. We ready for that? I just sort of don't believe it.
Deb Richter, you're a primary care doc. You ready to see 47 to 70,000 patients?
No, I don't think that we will be able to handle that amount. I do think we're going to end up, you know, if we get to the point where we're seeing more and more and more cases, we're going to see more school closures. And again, we end up with the problem, what do parents do when they have to stay home with their kids? Even if they're not sick, the school's closed. It's closed for several weeks. And even several months, maybe till the end of the year. Colleges, we now know, I believe Middlebury College is going to work remotely. They're not having any classes. We're going to see more and more of that. Those are the things that are necessary. You know, sort of more on the more positive side. I mean, Germany's tested tens of thousands of people. They found 1,000 positive. They've only had 2 deaths. One of the reasons, again, is they've identified early and isolated. Isolation, self-quarantine, all those things are essential to containing this. In China, they've managed to contain it because they have stopped any kind of major public events and closed schools, those sorts of things. We're going to have to consider doing those things. Will we have enough ICU beds? Should we see tens of thousands? No, we won't.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're dealing with another issue. Will we be dealing with deciding who gets those beds and who doesn't? That will be another question, and I can't answer that. I really think that's something that we need to think ahead. I think we need to have people thinking ahead about what we do should those tens of thousands present themselves and prepare for that.
Are we, I mean, I've seen in other parts of the world, even other parts of the country, some hospitals, I think out in California, they were erecting tents outside the main hospital building to screen patients coming in to be checked for COVID-19. Where's the stockpile of tents in Vermont to be set up outside of our hospitals?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's something that, you know, massive screening would actually help tremendously for us to contain this. As I said, in Germany, that's what they've done, and they've only had 2 deaths out of 1,000 people. So that's really, you know, one thing we've learned in this virus is to identify early and isolate. These are the things that are fundamental, and good hand hygiene, not touching your face, all those things that we already do know. We don't know a lot about again, who the vectors are. Is this really mostly children? We don't really even know at that point. We still have a lot more research to do.
244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255. If you'd like to check in with us here at WDEV FM and AM and speak with our two guests, Dr. Deb Richter and writer Hamilton Davis. They have been talking here about the COVID-19 virus and what it means for Vermonters, what we should be thinking about out there. We do have a listener on the line. Good morning, Nils from Duxbury.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My comment's pretty straightforward. Mr. Davis, in the past 10 minutes, has mentioned 2 numbers. One was 70%. And the other was 50,000. The 50,000 was, he said something to the effect, and I have to paraphrase, I heard a rumor that UVM had 50,000 test kits. The 70% number was a similar comment that somewhere he read or heard that many people might end up with corona. And then at the end of the sentence, he said, well, maybe that was the number of people we would have to test. My comment is that as much information as we have out here now, if you don't know what your numbers are, don't mention it. Don't begin to have people thinking about stuff that's based on A, rumor, B, conjecture, C, I'm not sure, but I heard. That to me just seems very irresponsible. Pardon me, but no one else is going to call you on it. I'm going to. Everybody wants to be safe, but you don't need postulating an uncertain throwing uncertain numbers around. And if I've misheard you, sir, pardon me, but that's what I heard.
Okay, thank you for the call, Nils. I just to be clear here, I think our number of 70% of the population likely contracting this. I'm a little hazy on this, but I believe we had two sources of that information. One was there was an estimate from Germany that was going to be the case with their population there. The other was that. Wasn't this the case, Ham Davis, that there was, or was it Deb? You said there was a CDC official saying this is likely to happen in the United States.
I'm not familiar with that number, and I agree with Nils. I think we don't want numbers bantered about, and these are also estimates. I think what we need to do is prepare. Should we get tens of thousands of people that contract this, we need to prepare with proper public health measures. And I agree with Nils that we need to make sure that we don't make people panic about test kits and that sort of thing. Again, we're using the common sense measures, public health measures, that I think we need to be responsible.
Okay. Ham, did you have anything to add?
I think there's a lot of things going on here. I don't agree with Nils, actually. I think that, and I function from a background not of medicine. Deb's a doctor, but I'm basically a journalist. And from a journalistic perspective, I think the right thing to do is find out as much reliable information as you can. The 70% figure on the people that might need to be tested is out of the New York Times. Now, you can say that the New York Times should say nothing. I don't agree with that. But I'd like to ask Deb another question because I think hasn't really been dealt with at all, and I don't see it anywhere, and that is the trajectory of this. What is the arc of this disease? We're getting reports that the number of cases is starting to ease off in both Korea and China. That is an arc of about 4 months where you get the disease comes in, it catches hold, it starts to proliferate through the population, lots of people get sick, some people die, and then it starts to ease off. And you get observations that I've seen in the press that the number of people, for example, in big Chinese cities who take the subway is increasing. What seems to indicate, certainly what the commentators, the people that write about it in the press think, is that that's the peak, and that the peak is may have passed in China and passed in Korea, but we are nowhere near the peak here. And I'm curious whether what Deb thinks about what the trajectory of this is. We know where we are roughly today. She knows as much about it as anybody that I know in Vermont. Okay. But if we look ahead, if we look in history, the Black Death in the 1300s went on for years and wiped out a third of the population of Europe. But the trajectory of the Spanish flu from 1918 to the middle of 1919, when it went away, was 15 months. Is there any way, so my question to Deb is there any way to tell what the arc of this disease is likely to be in this country? Are we talking about it's going to be out there as a big problem, really hammering people and the economy for 5 years, 2 years, 1 year? Is it likely to be over by Labor Day? Is it likely to be over by, does the medical community know anything about the arc in Vermont?
Well, again, I'm not an infectious disease specialist nor a public health specialist, so I want to make that very clear. I think from, again, what I've read, that one of the reasons that China was able to contain it had to do a lot with their response to this disease. By isolating people, closing schools, rapidly testing, once they realized what it was about. Initially, they could be faulted for not letting anyone know about it. But once they let the word get out that this was a potential epidemic, they responded, and other countries have done the same. And again, other countries with national healthcare systems and paid sick leave have done better. And Germany being one of a really good shining example. It's really more of our response to the disease. I'm not sure we know. I do think we'd be better equipped than we would be in 1918. To respond to it. I mean, one of the reasons they called it the Spanish flu, by the way, was the rest of Europe refused to be public about the fact that this sickness was happening, and Spain was the only country initially that was very open about it. So we really need to be, I think, keep the public informed but not panicked. And as far as how long it will last, I do not know. I think we need, again, to use proper public health measures, and we need some emergency measures so that people will stay home if they're sick. If they're told to quarantine, they will do so, but they won't have to have a financial penalty doing that, and they will seek their primary care or health professionals should they get symptoms.
All righty. We need to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. We'll be back shortly, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and we're going to continue a little bit into our second hour here with my same guest, because we're getting a lot of calls from listeners. We are getting into some very interesting and difficult conversation here about a very difficult topic, and that, of course, is the COVID-19 virus. We're all trying to grapple with what it means, that its arrival here in the world, in the United States, and in Vermont. And we are just trying to figure it all out as we go forward here, folks. I think an awful lot of people are in a range of positions as they approach this, but we're all sort of looking at it and going, huh? To help me do that this morning, we've had Deb Richter. Dr. Deb Richter is a primary care physician and an addiction specialist here in Vermont, who has been very interested in pursuing universal primary care for Vermont's residents, and she continues into the second hour with us. Really appreciate you staying around, Deb Richter. And Ham Davis, writer on healthcare issues, also with us. And as I mentioned, we have some callers who've been waiting, so let's get right to them. Chuck from Middlesex is up next. I do believe. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning. Good morning. I was just wondering, I've been in contact. The health department is not advocating at this time large gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't figure out why they wouldn't limit those, in the fact that we have several large hundreds of people going to gatherings throughout the state, including Chittenden County, Essex Fairgrounds, and every week there's a big event down there. And I asked about it, and nobody seems to really think that that's a good idea to limit those, or, I mean, I hate to use the word shut down, but basically that's what it is. And I understand, I can choose not to go,
mm-hmm.
but if 100 people do go, and there is a person from New York or New Hampshire or whatever there, and they get it, it's just going to spread that faster. Deb Richter said earlier before the break there that that's how China held it down somewhat from spreading more rapidly. So I was just wondering why the health department isn't monitoring this these large gatherings and maybe putting some input.
It's a good question, Chuck. I want to mention here there is at healthvermont.gov, there is an info page here, and one of the links actually says, what should people planning on large gatherings in Vermont do? And it says, at this time, the health department is not recommending closure or cancellation of mass gatherings or large events. It is reasonable for older adults and persons with underlying health conditions to consider not attending a mass gathering event. This guidance is subject to change based on the evolving situation. So it seems as though the health department actually could change that advisory, and then you have different stages of recommendation. You go from we think people ought to avoid large gatherings to all large gatherings are shut down by order of the health department. There's a range, sort of range of responses there as well. I think it's a good question, Chuck. And Deb Richter, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I would definitely avoid any kind of gathering. Should you, especially if you're over the age of 60, if you have health problems. I would agree. I think that's probably something that will be coming soon if we see a doubling or tripling of the cases over the next week or so, that will be something that will happen. Also closing schools, because there is a chance that kids are the vectors, as they are with the flu. And so we'll probably be seeing something like that. Again, I would continue, I would say, as Dave was saying, that connecting with healthvermont.gov and also the cdc.gov, their latest information, and check that twice a day because it seems to be rapidly changing as far as their recommendations.
Let's go to Alice and Warren. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning. I have sort of an odd question. I realized or researched and found out that China found that dogs were carriers of the Cronova virus, and they quarantined them. And I'm wondering, has there's been no mention of this in this country, as far as I've been able to find. What do you, Dr. Richter, know of any of this, or what they found? And also, I was wondering if dogs could be used for developing a vaccine. But apparently they're carriers, but they don't... you can't get it from the dog and cats.
Right. And I, again, would emphasize I'm not an infectious disease specialist nor a public health specialist. I again, had read something to that effect, too. I don't know enough about it to really comment. As far as carriers, let's keep in mind that humans are carriers of this disease, people who are asymptomatic. And that's, again, why we need to use the common sense of hand hygiene and isolating should we get sick, and staying home if you're sick.
You know, Dave, I think it's also worth mentioning that there have been shutdowns. Middlebury College is closed. I mean, they're doing classes online. I think Central School in Williston, I think, is closed. I mean, the health department may not be ordering anybody to do anything, but individual organizations, in fact, are taking steps, even in Vermont.
That's a very, very good point there. Let's go to one last call on this topic, and then I do have to shift gears here. But Tim in Corinth is on the line. Good morning, Tim.
Yes. I'd like to know how far the, if somebody sneezes and whatnot, how long does that disease hang out on a counter or whatever? And second of all, if they don't know, how long before they'll figure that out?
Well, first of all, within, your sneeze and cough can pollute a room up to 6 feet. So again, if you're around someone who's sick, you really ought to be standing as far away from them as possible. As far as how long it lives on surfaces, I do not know. I believe several hours, but again, I do not know with any kind of assurance to be able to say that. That is why you should wash down all surfaces where you come in contact with, especially in a public place like a grocery store, with, again, a sanitizer that has at least 60% alcohol. That would be something that, would be a wise thing to do. And even if we know, if you knew it was 3 hours, would you touch it 4 hours later and not wash your hands? Of course, that doesn't make sense. So it makes sense to just continue to wash your hands and wipe down surfaces that you've touched that may have contaminated.
All right. Well, I want to thank my guests, Dr. Deborah Richter and healthcare writer Hamilton Davis, for doing extra duty here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, talking about this difficult topic of the COVID-19 virus. The two of you, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
A few months ago, I think it was sometime last year or so, we had a visit from a gentleman named Stephen Wolfert, who is a veteran, U.S. military veteran, has had a lot of experience with PTSD and has decided to make an art form out of this. And Stephen Wolfert is going to be in the Central Vermont area over the next couple of weeks, putting on performances of his play, Cry Havoc, as well as participating in forums devoted to trying to help veterans who are trying to ease their lives of PTSD and reduce the symptoms there. And Mr. Wolfert just arrived in the studio in the last 15 or 20 seconds here, so I'm glad to see that you were able to make it in this morning. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And so I do recall we had you on the program once before, I do believe.
Last year before the show, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have you been bringing this show around the country since then?
Yeah. In fact, my wife and I converted a Mercedes Sprinter van because we're on tour full time. We travel around the country. We've put on over 100,000 miles in the last 2 years, hitting over 32 states, delivering not only Cry Havoc, the performance, but our program Decruit, which is a treatment program for veterans.
Mm-hmm. And so so it's really a two-pronged approach here with which you mm-hmm. return to Central Vermont here. And I know that you are one of the sort of touch spots for you here is Norwich University, of course, a big military presence at the nation's oldest private military college there in Northfield, Vermont. And so tell us, I think I saw a schedule indicating you have a couple of upcoming performances, including here in Waterbury at the Grange Hall Cultural Center. So let's see if we can get a little lineup going here. It says here, Cry Havoc performances, Stephen Wolfert's award-winning off-Broadway play, which details Wolfert's struggle with post-traumatic stress and addiction and explains how theater and Shakespeare provided him with the tools to overcome these challenges, free and open to the public with no tickets required. Let's see, Friday, March 13th, that's tomorrow night, folks, or two nights from today.
Tomorrow night we're at Grange Hall.
Tomorrow night you're at Grange Hall here in Waterbury.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And is that at 7 p.m. or
7:30? I believe.
Okay.
I have my phone out trying to find.
Yeah, trying to find out exactly what
we just drove up. We literally drove from Texas to get here, so we've been through quite a bit. Anyways, tomorrow night I think it's 7:30 at Grange Hall, and then we go to Norwich, and the rest of the performances are around Norwich in that area. Both performances by me as well as veterans who will be taking the Decruit workshops.
I see. Okay. And so Friday evening in White River Junction, says time and location to be determined. Do we have a time and location yet?
In Dartmouth. Oh, that's my wife, Dawn. She knows all. Dartmouth at what time?
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Dartmouth at 7 p.m. on, and is that going to be, do we know what forum? They have a couple different halls down there. Do you know,
I should have. Do you know?
We were at the VA, and then the VA had to.
Step on in and join us.
Here's the deal.
Don't be shy.
For information, it's really easy. Norwich University is going to have the information on the site.
Okay.
On their website.
On their website.
So Decruit, Cry Havoc shows, all the information will be on the website. Or they can email me directly at dawn@decruit.org.
Okay, Don.
Dawn.
Dawn. Pull up a chair here, Don. Join us in the WDEV studio. Thanks so much for doing so. We as I was saying, you visited with us last year, Stephen. And what kind of reactions have you gotten on these performances around the country over the year you've been traveling and doing this?
It's been astounding. The show isn't, everyone thinks it's for veterans, but the reality is veterans see this show and go, yeah, that's my story, or else that part of it is. The idea was to create a bridge of understanding between the veterans and their families and the communities. Mm-hmm. Most of the information that's in Cry Havoc, even though it's my personal story, we crafted it over a number of years with other veterans, getting their stories in there as well to understand what are our common themes that we struggle with. That's the reason our program is called Decruit, as a matter of fact. It comes from the show where I say, when I went into the military, I had a recruiter that helped prepare me for life in the military, gave me rides, helped me prepare the paperwork. Everything I needed was, well, I had help for anything I needed.
Yep.
But when I got out, there was no decruiter to help prepare me for every aspect of life after the military. Help me with paperwork or rides to the VA or whatever I needed, to a VSO, an American Legion or what have you. Mm-hmm. So we decided to do that. And what we realized as well is what I was going through is what whatever I went through, my wife was also going through. My family was going through that. If I had a bad day, they had a bad day because I was raining it down upon them. And this is all carried over because there isn't, I was, as I say again in the show, I was wired for war but never unwired from war. So now I still have that quick response to anger, that hot flash to respond to a threat with violence. You know, I have these instincts in me that were never undone. So to be able to go up and do the show for a community and have them then begin the dialogue afterwards with each other, that's our primary goal, and or to get connect them with services or even our own programming, the DECRU program, to actually begin unwiring from war.
Most veterans say, that's my story. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's the truth. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And most
civilians say, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah.
They have some Hollywood version of what it is in their head, and they just didn't know.
Yeah. Here's another group I'm wondering about their reaction, and that is, you know, there is some, and more so than there used to be, kind of official U.S. military Pentagon response to these issues of post-traumatic stress disorder, and just trying to, the VA has programs and others. Yeah. How are the official channels responding to what you're doing here?
Overall, it's been extremely positive and supportive. For example, multiple VAs around the country have been really interested, not only in Cry Havoc. In fact, there's been entire state VAs that are saying, we would like Cry Havoc to be mandatory viewing for all of our staff, and especially non-veterans. Quite a few VAs, statewide VAs, have wanted the DECRU program as well. So that shows that there is a shift. We've even had folks from TRADOC, Army Training Doctrine and Command, come and see it and agree with our premise that we're wired for war but never unwired from war. But there's also the usual resistance, and that's not just from government bodies. That's from mindset. Like Dawn said, there's this idea, this Hollywood idea, when in fact the biggest barriers we have are stigma or discrimination against what we think of a warrior should do when they come home. Because what the research shows is that the vast majority of veterans enter the military with trauma, and that's usually childhood trauma or cultural or family trauma from their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
This has been throughout our history, as a matter of fact. But we have data to show this now. And in fact, the VA and the Department of Defense have done their own studies that also support this. So we're dealing with old stuff that then the military can tend to exacerbate, which gives explanation to why there are veterans. When we look at the suicide rate, and I adopt the 22 a day, which is one every hour and 9 minutes that someone who served this country has killed themselves, the number is higher among non-combat veterans. So that tells us something else is going on. It's not combat, and it's not just military training. It's something else, and we believe we know what it is. It's the childhood trauma being undiagnosed, untreated, which is why we don't pathologize it. We don't require a diagnosis. We don't require a PTSD or anything of that sort. If you're a veteran and you served, you come in, and we're going to start helping to unwire you.
Okay. So in your travels around the country, has this been all over the place?
Yeah.
You said you came from Texas.
We have Florida, Hawaii, Texas. We're going to Washington. Chicago. We travel full-time doing it. So we've hit the entirety of the Northeast, good hunks of the Midwest, and some of the Southwest, as well as California as well. we have active decrew programs going in New York City, Fort Worth, Texas, Chicago, and hopefully soon in Fairbanks. There are a few others, but those are the four that are really, we're small. When I say we live in a van, it's not a metaphor. We're not doing Chris Farley. We literally are doing this as a grassroots organization to cut down our costs, be able to go into programs, go into communities, teach the program so that they can continue it on their own. And we just help support them to continue to grow the program.
That is pretty amazing stuff. Now, do you have a website if folks want to follow what you're up to?
We do. Thanks for asking. Ours is decruit.org. So think of the word recruit, but with a D. So DECRUIT.org.
Okay. And I mean, it's an interesting coinage, as you say, because the recruiting process, I mean, obviously they are trying to ease the road into into the military.
And they do it brilliantly.
They've had a lot of practice over the decades, and it would make sense that that would be a pretty smooth road at this point. Effort to bring people back into civilian life from the military, not as well practiced, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
And you would think we would. I mean, this is an ancient problem. This is why one of the many reasons we use Shakespeare. But it's not. So Shakespeare's writing this stuff about 400 years ago, and he's writing the military veteran experience perfectly. One of the best examples is a speech by a character called Lady Percy. Her husband is a combat veteran who's just returned home from combat that day and is leaving the next morning. She doesn't know this. He does. She asks him a series of questions. Oh, my good Lord, why are you thus alone? Why dost thou bend thine eyes upon the earth and startle so often when thou sittest alone? She asks all of these questions, and they're so perfectly describing post-traumatic stress that Jonathan Shea, a psychologist who worked with Vietnam veterans for over 30 years, takes that speech and next to each question lists questions from the Diagnostic Manual of Post-Traumatic Stress. And that's 400 years ago. He's writing precisely the symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
Wow. So this has been around for a long time. I know when the people say that at the end of World War I, they called it shell shock, this idea that people were coming back who had probably traumatic brain injuries and chemical exposure symptoms and all of, I mean, many, many similar things to where we are 100 years later.
Yes. And we've done nothing to change it. Not really. Not fully.
I wanted to say also, one of the things that we find so encouraging in this climate, going to states around the country, so-called blue and so-called red states, is this notion that the government is not the answer, and so therefore the community must be.
Yeah.
That's how you bring them back, and they're coming back to your community. So I really do want to just thank Norwich University, the Vermont Arts Council, Vermont Community Foundation, Vermont Humanities Foundation, and the community partners at White River Junction VA Medical Center and the Veterans Place in Northfield for bringing us in this month and committing to their community.
Wow. So you guys are here pretty much for the whole month of March, aren't you?
Yes. Really exciting.
And then
the
rest of the time at Norwich University.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Of course, Norwich is very involved in trying to help. They're training people for the military, and so I think they understand the other end of the mission as well quite thoroughly. So that's very interesting. You are Don Stern, clearly a key partner in this whole enterprise here.
Yes.
And
I actually quit my job 2 years ago to enter the nonprofit. And let me just tell you, we put the non in nonprofit. So if anyone wants to go to the website and donate and help us, feel free.
Alrighty, that's good to know. And the website once again is decruit.org, DECRUIT.org. And the two of you, I want to thank you so much for stopping by this morning. I wish you excellent luck in your travels around for our part of the world here as well as elsewhere. And
thank you so much.
And just keep using that hand sanitizer.
We will. We'll have plenty of it at Grange Hall tomorrow
night. Vermont,
right.
No known cases. Woo!
We actually have one now. So.
Oh, darn it.
Oh. Yeah. Alrighty, we're going to take a brief break here for the bottom of the hour news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and be back very shortly, folks. Stay with us.
Hey.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smart Wool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and after all this chatter about the COVID-19 coronavirus worries that are gripping the nation, the Vermont certainly, and the world as well, we want to shift gears a little bit here to talk politics, because yesterday was another key voting day in several primary states. And Paul Heinz of 7 Days has been very closely following the Bernie Sanders campaign for president, which if you're a Sanders fan, did not get much good news last night. Paul, give us a little recap.
Hey, Dave. Well, the short story is that it was a really bad night for Senator Sanders. He had basically camped out in Michigan for the several days leading up to the election, really hoping that he could change the narrative and show that he could win in a kind of key Midwestern battleground state. He did not. Mm-hmm. He got blown out of the water there. And, in places that should have been good for him, like Idaho and in Washington, he also didn't do very well. He lost Idaho, still counting in Washington, but it's neck and neck right now, which is really not good. I mean, that's a state that he won by a big majority 4 years ago. There are no good signs coming out of yesterday's elections. And, what's even worse is that a week from yesterday, there are more delegates up for grabs in states that are more that are better for Biden. Think Florida, for example.
Yeah.
Which has an older population, which has a population of immigrants who probably don't like what Sanders has said about Fidel Castro over the years. It's just not a good state for him. Georgia's coming up as well, and that's got a huge African-American vote. He's underperformed among African-Americans, especially older ones who are more likely to vote. So the bottom line is, you're really not looking good. It is harder and harder to see any kind of realistic path to victory for him at this point.
So he's 78 years old. This is pretty much the last rodeo for him, right?
Well, I mean, I thought that after the last presidential race, right? So, it is impossible to imagine that he runs for president again after this. But that doesn't mean he's not going to play a significant role, going forward. I mean, just imagine in a Biden administration, him being the face and the voice of the left and trying to keep Biden honest and keep him, from being too moderate. I could see him playing a very important role in such a scenario, obviously assuming that Biden wins. And I mean, that's another part of it, right? I think the role that Sanders plays in this general election is going to be hugely significant. Sanders motivates young voters like nobody else does. And there are so many Sanders supporters who really don't like Biden, who are, in my interviews with them, say they're no way sure that they're going to vote for the Democratic nominee if it's not Sanders. So Sanders is going to be essential to Biden winning this fall. So it'll be really interesting to see how Biden's people deal with that, right? They need to be very careful not to look like they're pushing Sanders out of the race. They need to find a way to be respectful of Sanders and of Sanders supporters. And then Sanders is going to have a really hard job in front of him as well, because I think he genuinely wants the Democratic nominee to win. But he's got a lot of supporters who are going to see this as a sham. They're going to have conspiracy theories about, why this happened. And he's going to have to find a way to kind of bring them along.
Yeah, I mean, what is your sense? I've seen a little bit of chatter online just this morning from really staunch Sanders supporters among Facebook friends and so on, who are saying things like, you know, there's some thumb drives in Texas or something. It sounds like a country tune, or I don't know. but there may be some skullduggery going on that have gone on in various primaries around the country. Is there any evidence at all of that? I mean, is there enough there for people to grab onto and say, gee whiz, this is another theft?
I have seen zero evidence, and I'd be highly skeptical. I mean, I think the story here is pretty simple, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders has not been able to pick up enough votes to win this thing. Sorry, that's a really lame analysis, but his theory all along was that that he could win the race with 30 to 35% of the vote, mm-hmm. As long as there remained a crowded field, and that theory, I think, wasn't a bad one. I mean, it was working.
Yeah.
Through Nevada. It was working up until South Carolina. And I think that it is really amazing and surprising and shocking that the more moderate elements of the Democratic Party managed to get their act together and actually, consolidate around one candidate really, really quickly. And I think that it's not a conspiracy. It's that Democrats learned the lesson from the Republican 2016 primary about what happens when you've got an insurgent candidate, who's steadily building support, and you got a whole lot of alternatives who are not willing to, put aside their own ambitions to stop that insurgent. And so Democrats, the other more moderate mainstream Democratic candidates learned that lesson. And that's why support has consolidated around Biden. You know, it's simple. I don't think it takes a conspiracy. And I also don't think that takes away from Senator Sanders and what he's accomplished here. I mean, it's really, it's amazing what he has done in this race, even if he doesn't win. And he's hugely influenced the dialogue. He's, he is very much, he's transformed the progressive movement. So I don't think we should discount what he's accomplished. But I also don't think that, resorting to conspiracy mongering is a responsible thing to do, especially in this era in which we live, where a lot of bad actors are spreading conspiracy theories all the time.
Yeah, and there are enough real conspiracies out there so that you shouldn't spread the fake ones, I guess.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I just like to put a positive spin on as much as I possibly can here. We have a caller on the line. Roger from Worcester's with us. Good morning, Roger.
Hey, good morning, guys. So I'd like to ask Paul this question and see what he thinks. Basically, I'm a big Bernie supporter. I'm pretty, I'm feeling pretty down about it. I guess looking at it, I'd like to see one or two things happen. First thing, I'd like to see, obviously, Biden basically reach out to the progressive left and by doing something. But some of the stuff that he's been coming out with is totally the opposite. And if anything, he seems to be going much more toward the sort of never Trumper Republican GOP, sort of a GOP light Democratic Party kind of mode. And if they're going to leave the left out in the cold like that, then a lot of people are going to write in Bernie Sanders. And I think on November 3rd, I'd like to see the state of Vermont write in Bernie Sanders' name and send a little message to the Democratic Party. However, if they reach out to us, if they reach out to the progressive left, and I'm not sure they will, because Biden said something or gave signals to the effect that he may veto Medicare for all. And, Obama really didn't even discover the climate crisis issue until his sixth or seventh year in office. I got to tell you, with the kind of policies that Biden would support and the people he's cozying up to, I mean, they're talking about Jamie Dimon for Secretary of Treasury. Do you really, NAFTA and all this, do you really think that the left is actually going to vote for Biden? Boy, if not, I would say send a message and write in Bernie for November 3rd, and I'll take your comments offline. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, Roger. Yeah. Paul, what do you think of all that?
Well, Roger, first of all, I'm very sorry for your disappointment in this outcome. I think you raised some really interesting and valid points here that, and I you know, I think the onus is now on Biden to make the correct overtures to Sanders supporters. You know, traditionally the way things have worked in American politics is in a primary, Democrats tack to the left and Republicans to the right to appeal to their bases, and then they, you know, move toward the middle during the general election. I think I agree with you that that would be a pretty poor choice for Biden right now. I think he does have to find ways to extend an olive branch to Sanders supporters, and I think that's going to take some policy moves. And let's not forget Elizabeth Warren and her supporters as well, right? Between the two of them, Warren still has not endorsed anybody. They are both substantive politicians who are looking for real policy change. So, I think right now Biden needs to be looking for ways to send a message to Bernie and Warren supporters that, he will fight for certain things that they believe in. Maybe it's not Medicare for all, but maybe it's climate change. You know, maybe it's, Warren's anti-corruption platform. Those are things that perhaps could be easier for him to get behind. Similarly, I think that that Sanders and Warren have some leverage right now. I think it's an interesting question of when they have the most leverage. You know, like, does it make sense for Sanders to kind of get what he can get now from Biden and get out quickly? Does it make sense for him to kind of stay in for a little bit and be a pain in Biden's, to try to, get more concessions? But at a certain point, I think that is what those two candidates will want to get. And I'll be really interested to see how they kind of do that dance.
Paul, let me try out sort of the other kind of the devil's advocate role here to some extent, and push back a little bit on Roger and on the Sanders supporters. In 2016, I remember I still had a sort of straight reporter job. I wasn't able to express opinions like a radio talk show host back then, but I was telling close friends and family.
You're not unleashed yet.
I wasn't unleashed. That's right. Yeah, I was telling close friends and family, a lot of whom were disappointed to see the treatment that Sanders gotten, and were not thrilled about Hillary Clinton, and I was saying, I remember saying repeatedly to people, this isn't really about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. This is about the Supreme Court, and this is about the overall direction of the government. The president, after all, in many ways, really is just a figurehead. And, what matters is, and we've seen this in spades. We've seen that what matters on immigration policy, even more than Donald Trump, may be Stephen Miller. And what matters on environmental policy, or what matters on education policy, is Betsy DeVos, you got to kind of really keep in mind not just the individual, and whether you like Hillary Clinton's personality or you think Joe Biden has all his marbles or whatever, you sort of have to say, what kind of team are they going to bring in? What kind of court appointments are they going to make? What sort of overall direction for the country is going to be happening here? And, for Bernie, any Bernie Sanders supporter to tell me now they're thinking about sitting home in November after watching the first 4 years of Donald Trump, to me, that just strikes me as really crazy, frankly.
Well, and I am not as unleashed as you, because I'm not a radio talk show host quite yet. But, I would say that another way to look at it is, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, maybe it's worth listening to what Bernie Sanders says. What he says literally every time he delivers a speech is that Donald Trump has to be defeated, right? And Democrats must coalesce around the Democratic nominee, whether or not it's Bernie Sanders. That is what Sanders himself has been consistently arguing for the last year. And I think, that Sanders makes that argument because he's pragmatic, and he knows that, if you believe in the things that Bernie Sanders believes in, you are going to be a lot better off under any Democratic administration than you are under Donald Trump. And so I find it quizzical. I mean, I totally understand why people like Roger, are so upset about this outcome that they would consider, not voting for the Democratic nominee. But that appears to be counter to what Sanders himself thinks is the pragmatic thing to do. So, you know, I don't know. Well, but at the same time, to argue with myself a little bit here, Sanders has, through his rhetoric, raised questions about kind of the legitimacy of the Democratic establishment. And, he is not a conspiracy monger, but some of his surrogates have engaged in that kind of rhetoric. And, you know, certainly during the 2016 campaign, his campaign quite clearly sort of raised the Democratic National Committee as a boogeyman who, you know, which was trying to steal the nomination from him. So there is, I think, some he has a responsibility now to make the case to his own supporters why they now should support the establishment, right? He's got to kind of turn that ship around a little bit. And I think he's going to do that. I think that's, you know, Sanders is pragmatic. I say it all the time, but, like, he's not, you know, maybe he has, you know, maybe some people think his politics are radical, but his approach to politics is really not that radical. He wants to get what he can get to advance his beliefs.
Did Biden win, what, 4 out of 6 primary caucuses last night, Paul?
Yes, he won 4 out of 6, and Bernie won 1, North Dakota, and then the 6th, Washington, is outstanding.
Still being counted or whatever, yeah. Okay.
That's right.
Let's go to a couple callers on the line. Gene from Barrie. Good morning, Gene.
Hello, good morning. I think Bernie sounds a lot like Trump. He's going to do wonders, and then he gets in there and they do nothing. I think Biden is more qualified.
Okay, that's it.
In my opinion, I think he's more qualified because Bernie sounds to me like a lot like Trump did when Trump campaigned the first time.
That's an interesting perspective. What's the biggest similarity between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, would you say, Gene?
To me, of course, he's going as a Democrat, but he's not a Democrat anyway. I don't know. He sounds to me like he's more for Trump, but he don't want to admit it.
I don't know about that, but we'll see here. It looks like Biden is on track, and thank you for the call, Gene. I appreciate it. Let's go to Robert in Bristol. Good morning, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am an avid Bernie fan, but I would like to stress the fact that all Bernie fans, all progressives need to vote with the Democratic Party, no matter who it is that comes out. But the party itself needs to realize that without progressives in the future, it is not going to win. Without the progressive support, the party needs to at least move in that direction. And the current moves that was another caller brought up, that they were talking about for the cabinet, that's not moving at all. And, a really good idea, I think, right now during this coronavirus would be to have Medicare for all. Anyway, that's just the point I wanted to make.
All right. Thanks for the call, Robert. Appreciate it. Paul, what do you think? Do you think that the Democrats are kind of putting off a final reckoning here? I mean, imagine. Let's assume that Biden gets the nomination and that they take this kind of moderate standard bearer to election day, and that the Democrats really kind of continue on their pattern that they've had now for a long time, ever since Bill Clinton, really, this sort of triangulation where they try to scoop up as much of the center as they can. Is that a workable thing, or they still need to work this out at some point?
So I think Robert is totally right. And I think that one of the dynamics here is that people, and the exit polls really bear this out, a lot of people are voting super strategically this time around, and because they despise Trump, they're terrified of a second Trump term. And so they are putting aside their own more liberal beliefs in order to support someone who they view, rightly or wrongly, is more electable, right? But I think it is quite clear that the Democratic Party is moving, or at least has moved, to the left. And this is especially true generationally. I don't know what the exact cutoff is, but anyone 30 or under, 40 or under, is far more progressive. Anyone in the Democratic Party, I should say, far more progressive than older generations are. And that's where Bernie has been getting a lot of his support. Those people, you know, the problem for Bernie right now is that those people aren't turning out in great numbers. But they will in future years. You know, they're going to get older. They're going to become more reliable voters. And it's quite possible they'll stay as progressive as they are right now. And so I think it's absolutely true that the Democratic Party is putting off a bit of a reckoning. And, you know, fine, nominate Biden right now. But I think in the future, there will be a progressive standard bearer for the party. And I also think, you know, the point that even floating the possibility of Jamie Dimon being the Treasury Secretary is, like, just insane, you know, just from an electoral perspective, right? Like, that is not the way that you bring in supporters, more progressive supporters. That is not the future of the Democratic Party. So, again, you know, Biden's going to have to kind of do that very delicate dance. He is more moderate than Sanders, but just another point on that, and sorry I'm rambling a bit now, but Biden is really actually slightly more liberal than Obama was when Obama ran in 2008. And so I think, you know, because this has been, this primary has been so dominated by progressive ideas, thanks to Sanders, it appears that, you know, this shift to Biden is a really big move to the right, but actually it's not so much, you know, the things he is talking about are absolutely more progressive than what his own running mate was talking about in 2008. So anyway,
yeah, that, you know, I mean, I think that one of the real fundamental questions here for the Democrats, and maybe this is oversimplifying it terribly, but this is talk radio after all. Are you with Wall Street or are you, you know, against Wall Street? Are you willing to be skeptical of Wall Street? You know, I think Elizabeth Warren tried to set down a marker on this question. I think that Hillary Clinton clearly did when she went and gave those Goldman Sachs speeches in secret for six-figure sums and then wouldn't reveal their contents. I think that hurt her a lot that clearly marked her as not a member of the 99% when she did that in leading into the 2016 campaign. And I'm just wondering where you see that. I mean, is that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, Trump also exploited that pretty effectively, right? He, in his 2016 campaign, he very much played the role of a populist and he claimed that he would be, you know, supporting Main Street over Wall Street. Of course, in the end, his policies have absolutely supported Wall Street far more than Main Street. But, you know, that is, populism is really powerful. And, you know, one upside for Joe Biden is that he has historically had this reputation of being, you know, middle-class Joe. Maybe you don't buy it, but, you know, he has been seen over the years as a guy who fights for the working class. He needs to stick to that in order to win this election. If he, you know, he needs to be careful about these fancy fundraisers with Wall Street executives. He needs to be super careful about floating the idea of Jamie Dimon being his Treasury Secretary. He has to send the right signals to the electorate that he is actually going to fight for working class Americans, or he is going to have a really, really hard time bringing Bernie voters in.
He needs to stay out of wine caves.
He definitely needs to stay out of wine caves. And he's got to think about, you know, with his running mate. He needs to, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea if he can find a more progressive person to join him on the ticket. I think that could help a little bit.
Let's see. I don't want to mention any names, but the initials EW come to mind.
The initials EW do come to mind. You know, I do think, though, there's also going to be a lot of pressure on him, rightly so, to have a person of color on the ticket. That's going to be a challenging question for him.
Alrighty. Hey, Paul Heinz, I thank you so much for joining me on short notice this morning. Always good talking with you.
Likewise. Thanks, Dave.
And that is, we're fast approaching the top of the hour and the end of the Dave Graham Show here for this Wednesday, March the 11th, 2020. Listeners, thanks so much for joining us this morning. A lot of great phone calls from you out there. And stay healthy, everybody. Have a good day, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.